Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 5517, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It will turn into a public hearing when we get more folks. And for the purpose of introducing the budget bill, Ms. Dyster, would you assist the committee?
You bet. Good afternoon. Today we are here for Senate Bill 5517. Your materials are posted under meeting materials under today's date. There's a full copy of the governor's budget document. There is the legislative fiscal office sort of overview, as well as the agency presentation and slide deck. Under tomorrow's materials, you'll have the CFO office presentation. So if we get there today, we may jump ahead. We're not noticed for public testimony on this budget until tomorrow. So we would have to, you know, in the event that folks finish earlier than anticipated, we would still have to come back tomorrow.
That's fine.
Colleagues, any questions of the professional staff? There being none, I'm going to invite Commissioner Avakian and who all from Team Bowley is going to come up. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll get started.
Co-chairs, committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Labor, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I thank you very much for the opportunity for us to present our budget to you, and look forward to a good discussion about what our agency does. I will give you a fairly quick overview of the mission of the agency, a little bit about how our budget is comprised, and then we have with us the administrators and directors of the various divisions of the Bureau that will drill down a little deeper and give you some more specifics about what each of the divisions does and how that relates to their budget. And I also will not exactly follow the slides. Some of those are just there for your benefit. Background. Thank you, Terry. Just a little bit about the agency history. It was established in 1903, and in many ways the mission continues to be to take care of Oregon's workforce, see that we've got the best trained workforce that you can find anywhere on the globe, and that employers have everything they need in order to be successful. The Bureau is really comprised of four different main areas. In protecting Oregon's workforce, we have the state's wage and hour division. Gerhard Teubel is the administrator, and you'll hear from him in a minute. The wage and hour division enforces our minimum wage laws, meal and rest periods, sets and enforces the prevailing wages for the state. We also have the state's civil rights division, which protects people in employment, housing, and public accommodations, keeping Oregonians free from discrimination. Amy Clare is the administrator, and you'll hear from Ms. Clare. We also have the state's technical assistance for employers program. Jennifer Germanson is the director of that program. This is our face to Oregon's business community, where we receive around 20,000 calls a year from businesses looking for help navigating their way through very complicated state and federal laws, and do seminars in all four corners of the state.
And Mr. Labor Commissioner, how do you interact with the Secretary of State's business portal?
Madam Co-Chair, they serve in many ways two different purposes. The Secretary of State, of course, incorporates businesses and helps them get off to a good start. We, in turn, do trainings and have the helpline that gets about 20,000 calls a year for technical assistance, helping employers throughout the term of their business. However, we do try and coordinate, and we have worked with the Secretary of State's office as near as the last year in order to get information out to new businesses that are just starting up that this very valuable resource exists for them. And we're hoping that that's just one way that we'll get the word out more and help businesses be even more successful because they know that the resource exists.
Co-Chair Gumberg.
Thank you, Senator. And you read my mind, but I was going to rephrase the question a little bit. And Commissioner, if you'd rather have your department have answered this question for me, I'm perfectly fine. But you do have a wonderful resource here. And I was thinking not so much of the business portal at the Secretary of State's office as the Office of Small Business Assistance, which takes phone calls and answers questions or helps people that have different challenges in different areas. And was also thinking about services offered, say, for example, through the Employment Division that answers questions for employers about specific employment practices. Is there some overlap there or redundancy, or is there some distinction amongst these good resources?
Mr. Co-Chair, you bring up a very good point. I don't know that there is overlap in services that are being provided. However, we do all deal with large pools of employers, and there are various ways to get information to employers, and we've in many different ways work with the Employment Department in order to get that kind of information out, with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, with the Governor's Office and the Secretary of State's Office. Some of you are very familiar with the effort on bringing shop classes back to the middle schools and the high schools. That's been an effort that has had us working with contractors around the state, developers around the state, and the Department of Education on the government side in order to do that program. And so we look as often as we can for a way to get our information out to businesses so that we're as accessible as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
And then we, of course, have a very large hand in the state's workforce development system by certifying apprenticeship programs. Steve Sims is the administrator of the State Apprenticeship Division, and you will hear from him shortly as well. We've got about 100 employees in the office with a budget of about $24 million. We have included for you an organizational chart, which I won't go through with you, but which is there for your benefit.
Who, Mr. Labor Commissioner, who's running the show? I looked at your organizational chart, and I look at the audience, and that's pretty much all of your boxes, is it not?
Madam Co-Chair, we have a lot of sub-boxes we didn't include on the chart for you. we've included, just for a historical perspective, the amount of FTEs since the early 90s with the agency. You can see a steady decline in the amount. If we were to have included a similar trend for the jurisdictional areas that we have added to the agency through that time period, you would have seen the exact opposite. There's been an incredible growth in the amount of things and the diversity of things that we do. I don't mention any of that by way of complaining, but just to let you know that even as tough decisions have had to be made over the years, that the agency has learned to do more with less and is fulfilling its mission. So that information is there just for historical perspective for you. We wanted to give you an idea of the budget sources, and so this pie chart shows you that we've got a pretty even split between general fund and other funds that go to the agency. And in those other funds, primarily due to contracts that we have with the federal government and with various local jurisdictions in order to enforce employment laws and housing laws, provide resources to veterans. And then, of course, the supportive services grant that you increased in the last biennium that allows us to help underwrite the cost of some of the services allowing women and people of color to have access to apprenticeships. And I might add with great success. Mr. Sims will give you the details on it, but because of the good work that you and the agency have done in increasing supportive services, women in Oregon are entering the trades at about twice the national average. The next just gives you a little more specific information about the breakdown of our budget between the divisions and the sources, general fund versus other fund, between those. And then lastly, we wanted to give you an idea of some of the legislation that the Bureau has before the legislature this biennium, or this session. Nearly all of these have no or a minimal fiscal impact. The only exception to that would be Senate Bill 380, which deals with housing cases. And I wanted to give you just a little bit of an idea about why I'm highlighting that. Currently, the Bureau has what's called substantial equivalency with federal housing law. And that enables us to have a contract with HUD in order to do federal housing discrimination investigations and enforce the state and federal housing law in Oregon. They pay us to do those cases. They don't pay as much as it costs to do each of those cases. And there is a provision within the Oregon law that gives us substantial equivalency that says that if an individual removes the case from our agency and takes it to circuit court, which they have the right to do under the law, that the Bureau must provide the resources and the representation for that individual in the circuit court. What that means is that we end up paying the fees and court costs for these cases that get taken out of our agency to court. That costs the agency between $20,000 and $40,000 a month, and we believe that's going to increase. So we have a bill before the legislature which changes that provision so that the agency is not on the hook for paying all of those fees and costs when a case gets removed in order to go to court. I mention it only because I'm sure there will be a discussion at some point about whether that policy should be changed or whether or not additional money should be provided in order to pay for housing discrimination cases. But other than that one bill, there is not a significant fiscal impact on anything else that we have before the legislature. With that, Madam Co-Chair, that will end my overview of the agency, and unless you have any questions for me right now, I'll invite Steve Sims, the apprenticeship director, up to present.
Thank you for your presentation. We'd invite Mr. Sims to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Johnson, co-chairs, committee members. Stephen Sims, S-I-M-M-S. I am the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'd like to give you an overview of our program. I know Senator Johnson's familiar with registered apprenticeship, but for those of you who are not, this is different from a mechanic or a violin maker saying, I'm going to apprentice this kid to learn how to do what I do. Registered apprenticeship is a structured binding contract between employer groups and students to learn a career in an occupation. Registered apprenticeship consists of industry-recognized training standards. In other words, a given occupation says we want everyone to train up to a certain level, plus supervised, paid on-the-job training and mandatory classroom instruction. Upon completion of this defined program of training, an individual receives two things: a nationally recognized credential. They can go anywhere they want to and work with that journey card, but more importantly, they have a career. The role of the Bureau of Labor and Industries in this regard is threefold. We facilitate partnerships between business and industry to ensure that they have a trained workforce. We assist individuals in finding the training that they need so they can start on a family wage career. And we work hard to make sure that the opportunity to obtain those careers are available to every Oregonian. Our programs graduate on average about 1,200 new journey workers every year. When the economy's good, maybe 1,300, 1,400. When the economy's bad, maybe less. But the bottom line is the average starting wage for a new apprentice in this state is $15.75 an hour on average. The average wage upon completion of an apprenticeship program is $28.88 per hour. This is efficient, low-cost workforce investment for the state, as no public dollars fund registered apprenticeship outside of our budget. And the best thing is that those apprentices pay taxes, and so we like to have that.
Mr. Sims, I've had the privilege of going to a couple of the apprenticeship schools, just to tour the facilities, and the thing that has always amazed me is that there isn't a line snaking out around the block. Why is it that people don't seem to avail themselves of the opportunity to get this kind of training?
Co-Chair Johnson, I think that what you see is different from the reality. For every apprenticeship opening that our programs have, they get about 10 and a half applications for every opening that's out there. We don't see the long lines that they did when I got started in this, because very few of the programs have you come to their training centers anymore and fill out a paper application. Most of them are online. There's a great demand for people looking for these career opportunities. I think one of the big problems is that the industry is having a hard time finding qualified people to start on these opportunities. But yes, there are people who are lined up to get into these programs. They're just queued up online.
Thank you for that. Representative Whitsitt, I'm going to come back. I got another question.
Oh, that's okay. I was wondering how you select the people for the apprenticeship positions, and if you have rules against familial recommendations or filling apprenticeships based on what the father was there, or uncle, or whatever.
Through the co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, pursuant to federal law, every apprenticeship program has to have a formal selection method. Mm-hmm. Those selection methods are supposed to be based upon objective standards relating to the ability to perform in the trade. One of the things that our office does is review the selection roles to make sure that there's a representation of women and people of color. We review the application process. Some programs have aptitude tests. All of them have interviews. We're there to make sure that that is fair and above board. With respect to familial preferences, we're against them. We believe, and I believe federal law supports us in this regard, that an individual should be selected for an apprenticeship based upon their merits. There is a strange wrinkle in our statutory structure that states that if an individual is related to an employer who is approved to train apprentices, and when that individual who is related rises to the top of the selection list, they can go, if they so choose, to the family employer. We don't see that used very often. We think that we have our best chance at diversifying the workforce if people are chosen on merit.
Mr. Sims, something in your earlier comments led me to believe that maybe you were getting applicants that were not fully qualified. And I'm making the assumption that many of these applicants would be coming directly out of high school. Have you tracked any of the trends that suggest deficiencies that you could work with the K-12 folks to address? For example, many of the building trades would have to have strong math, I would assume. And how we characterize what your incoming class looks like in terms of whether you are doing remedial or...
Certainly, Madam Co-Chair. Our programs complain about having to do remedial math and, in some cases, remedial reading classes. The average age of an incoming apprentice, and we don't recalculate this every year, but in my 22 years of doing this, has always been somewhere between 27 and 28 years. We just don't get a lot lower for new people coming into the industry.
Thank you for that correction.
A part of that, I believe, though, is a belief on the part of employers that before they entrust you with this great career, you have to have tons of experience. But I think another part of it, and this is completely anecdotal from our training directors, is they see young people coming in, they don't have the necessary math skills, they don't know what the trades are, they don't know what these career opportunities are. There are, in isolated pockets throughout the state, programs focused at preparing youth for the trades, but they're fledgling. They are not fully grown. As I'll talk about a little bit later, we are making efforts to work with our agency partners, and I guess I'll jump to this right now. One of the partnerships we're working on with the Department of Education is for them to take one of their curriculum supervisors, station them in our office, and then work with our apprenticeship committees and local school districts to say, you have the manufacturing career pathway in your school. There's a manufacturing program in your region. How do we articulate the outcomes from the manufacturing pathway to the apprenticeship pathway? We want to do that with construction. We want to do that with the industrial trades. We know that there's a need to reach out. There's a lot of work going on at low levels, and I think over time, we will see that build to a hearty program as the effects of the career and technical education grants begin to come to the fore, and school districts say, how do we connect to the jobs that are there? How do we provide employers with the resources that they're looking for? But right now, your question is, what's the profile of the average person coming in? About 27 years old, about 2 years of college, and little or no experience in actually working in the trades.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
To what degree do you work with community colleges?
Through the co-chair, Senator Monroe, we have two different relationships with the community college, and one is as a related training provider. As I stated earlier, all of our programs have to have theoretical classroom learning. It's essential to their program. Many of our larger programs work with their own international associations to develop curriculum. That curriculum has to be approved by the Office of Community Colleges and therefore the Department of Education. For those programs that don't have their own curriculum, they use state-approved curriculum from the Department of Education. So they are a provider of related instruction for our program. The other side goes with respect to outreach and recruitment. Most of our programs try to coordinate with the equity specialist at every community college and with the placement specialist and find out whether or not they have applicants or individuals who meet the minimum qualifications of the trade. One thing that we've been pushing them to do more and more is if they see the community college has a large construction technology program, but those individuals have not applied for an apprenticeship, to go out and solicit those individuals. So we have a good working relationship with the community colleges. We understand it could be more robust, and the more we can leverage their services on behalf of our programs, I think we'll wind up getting them better applicants.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. It seems like there's a theme in almost every legislative session, and this one, early as it is, seems to be developing around workforce. And I'm trying to figure out one of the themes. I'm trying to figure out, you mentioned the career and technical education grants, and you've got employment doing grants, and you've got community colleges or looking for money. Where is the air traffic control that is going to avoid duplication? And with the amount of money that we're talking about, I think that there's a huge possibility to have duplicative programs.
Madam Co-Chair, I don't disagree with you at all. I think that for a few years, the various agencies and partners involved, I won't say we're going at cross ends, but we're not completely coordinated. I think with some of the changes that you're seeing with the State Workforce Board and with the Employment Department, we've recognized that need for coordination. We've recognized the need for the Department of Ed to be lockstep with whatever our workforce development strategy is. I'm not going to say it's there yet, but I can tell you that Lisa Neisenberg at Employment has been very big on saying, if we have an investment in education that benefits workforce going on, how do we tie it into the workforce investments that we are making? Again, leveraging the education investment on workforce. It's not there yet, but I'm confident that we're doing a better job of working in that direction than we have in the last 15 years.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
I will, thank you. Our employer base is relatively large, about 4,400 employers, but one thing that is troubling to us is very few of our employers have more than one apprentice at any time. Part of that is because the majority of our programs are in the building and construction trades, so you have a contractor who may, for a six-month project, have five or six apprentices. When that project's over, those apprentices go back to the program, that employer does not continue to put on apprentices because they're not working a large project. We believe that one way to change that mix of apprentices to employers is to facilitate more partners with our with the industrial and manufacturing occupations. Only about 15% of our programs are in the industrial and manufacturing occupations, and there you're talking about stable employment, fixed site. If we can get apprentices in there, they're going to proceed through their programs and journey out. I'd say over the past couple of years, we've spent the majority of our time conducting compliance on our programs, making sure they follow state and federal regulations, and providing technical assistance. But we're beginning to turn our attention to outreach now, and not just outreach to high school students and underserved populations. We need to do a better job of outreach to employers. We need to let them know that this combined strategy of structured on-the-job, paid on-the-job training and classroom instruction is the best way for them to get the kind of worker that they're looking for.
Mr. Sims, let me stop you. You said paid. Paid by whom?
Co-Chair Johnson, a registered apprenticeship, the employer, not the apprenticeship program, not the state of Oregon, pays the wages for the registered apprentice. So this is why I say it's a great workforce investment strategy. With the wages that apprentices make and the taxes they pay on those wages, there's really minimal state investment. A big concern about getting more employers on board is they don't necessarily want to pay to get their trained workforce. They expect them to drop from the sky out of the education system. More and more employers now understand that they have to be engaged in what they're doing to develop their own workforce. So we push the idea that is the essence of registered apprenticeship, which is supervised paid on-the-job training.
One other question that this begs is, as you're trying to expand it to more employers, have you anticipated what effect ballot measure 91 and the implementation of the recreational marijuana program is going to have on a trained workforce, particularly when I think about some of the apprentice programs that are in the building trades where safety is at such a premium and you have somebody going out and smoking a joint for lunch. Tell me what you're doing to anticipate that.
Co-Chair Johnson, I know that the Department of Justice is already at work on that issue, and I know our Technical Assistance for Employers unit is already at work on that issue. But that's interpreting what the impact of ballot measure 91 will be, how employers will deal with it. The industries we work with this are dealing with these issues on their own. As you may know, on every prevailing wage contract in the state of Oregon, this is for our partners in the construction trades, every contractor on a prevailing wage project must have a random drug testing program in place. With respect to the manufacturing sector, and again, this is anecdotal from talking with our industrial employers, but they drug test the day they hire the employee, they drug test randomly. So this is one where there will be a need for technical assistance to interpret individual situations, but the industry, I believe, is doing a good job of anticipating what the impact will be. I know from our construction industry partners, they don't and cannot afford to have people under the influence of any type of intoxicant on the workplace. Their insurance companies don't want that, and I think that they're going to do everything they can to make sure that that does not come to pass, so we don't have people unable to perform their jobs.
I would just add anecdotally, I have employers in Clatsop County that advertise for really good jobs, high-paying benefits, medical, and they used to make a drug test part of the application process, but so many applicants failed that they have now turned it into, it's the applicant's responsibility, assuming they're offered the job, to show up with a clean UA. It became a cost center.
And that's an interesting question, Senator Johnson, because federal law does not allow our programs to drug test until the individual has been offered an apprenticeship opportunity. But I can tell you, once they get that opportunity and they're dispatched, and every one of our opening announcement has, must be drug and alcohol free, employer does test. If they fail that test, they're out, which is a wasted opportunity.
And is it just that swift, one strike and you're out?
The Senator Johnson, the only wrinkle is most of our programs that are affiliated with a union have clauses that state that when an individual turns up with a positive UA, that they must immediately enroll in a drug treatment program, and if they complete that program within 6 months, they may resume their place in the apprenticeship program. Otherwise, most of our programs will simply boot people for a positive drug test.
Representative Whitsitt, you look like you've got a question.
Our district has the same problems. We can't find people to work jobs because they can't pass a drug test, basically.
And again, if I just may say, I think the industry is aware of this issue, and they'll continue to prosecute solutions on their own, and our agency, through our technical assistance unit, will be there to assist them. The only other thing I want to talk about on this slide is that in the last calendar year, 2014, we graduated 180 female and minority apprentices. That's a small number, but the number is beginning to grow. And I point out the fact that that's a graduation because the bottom line for us is we want people turning out of programs. The agency in 1997 made a seismic shift in how we did business. One of those things was to focus on completion. We just did not want people registered in programs but not completing their program in a timely fashion. So that's one of our criteria now, one of our performance measures, completions per year. But of course, a registered apprenticeship depends on work and jobs being available. So a view of our completions over the last few years shows that in 2014, we fell well below our anticipated average of 1,200 completions per year. That's primarily due to the fact that most of those apprentices who graduated in 2014 started their apprenticeship during the Great Recession of 2008-2014. New registrations decreased sharply during that period through 2010. In 2010, we only registered 1,032 new apprentices, which is about one-third of the number we normally register. So as time went on, with less work for those apprentices who came in 2008-2009, it took longer for them to get out of their program, fewer new apprentices came in, therefore we get to 2014 and we have that low number. I am happy to report, however, that in calendar year 2014, we registered 2,851 new apprentices, and our current registration of active apprentices is up to 6,200. We anticipate at the current rate we're going on, only 3 months into the calendar year, we're going to be up to around 3,000 registrations for this year. So we think in another couple of years, as the workforce builds back up, we will once again exceed 1,200 new journey-level workers in the near future. Of those completions, the number of women and minorities, again, we focus on completion for everyone, but we have lots of research that we've done that show women and people of color have much lower completion rates from their programs. The numbers have been up slightly. Since 2005, we've gone from 12% of all registered apprentices, minority apprentices completing their program to almost 15%. I want to point out that we know that there is an issue with access to trade opportunities for women, not only access but completing them from their program. In order to find out what we can do to address that, we have been working with Portland State University and with a series of interns to pinpoint some of the root causes for the underrepresentation of women in the trades, not only entry into our programs but also completion from the program. We have some good evidence on some of those root causes, things that we all know about: workplace attitudes, pay inequity, and harassment. The challenge for us is to work with our industry partners to develop solutions to correct that. Our goal, long term, is to get that percentage of minority completions up to 20%. If we can ever get female completions up to 10%, I will feel that we've moved a major hurdle to create some degree of equity. As I stated earlier, We don't have that much.
Excuse me, Mr. Sims, co-chair number.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Sims, I just want to go back to this number of minorities and women's involved in the program. You're talking about the completion rate, and I was struck by the number 180 new women and minorities in the program, and I was trying to reconcile that against the total of about 6,000 involved in the program at all. You referred to that as a small number. Respectfully, I'd say it's a minuscule number, maybe a third of a percent, if I'm understanding those numbers correctly. Is that in fact accurate, that only less than a 1% of your participants in the apprenticeship program are women and minorities?
And Representative Gomberg, I may have misspoken. That's 180 completions.
All right.
Right now, of our overall apprenticeship active registration as of the end of February, about 6.5% of our apprentices are women, and about 16.5% are protected class minorities. So that 180 completions out of female and minority completions in 2014 out of 860 completions comes out to about 16%. That's still, I won't say minuscule, but it's still too small. But no, I think that we have built our female and minority participation numbers up, particularly as the slide shows, for minorities over the year. But you're not there with respect to minorities till you get to about 21.5%. That's the minority representation in the general workforce. And we're nowhere close to where we should be for active participation for women. That's our challenge to get there.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification, Madam Co-Chair. I was squinting at the charts. The numbers jumped out at me. I'm glad I asked for some clarification.
And I'll work on those charts to make sure that's clear. We have had some success, though, with respect to minorities, and to be quite honest, part of that is because a large portion of that minority population is male, and it is easier for men to make it in the trades. So our numbers have gone up. We note that 2011, when the recession was still in full bore, we had a large spike with respect to minority participation. And in our efforts to try to figure out why that was, the only conclusion that we could make is that a lot of the work in the construction industry during the recession was on public works projects. And a lot of public agencies finally began to enforce the EEO provisions in their contract. That's why we believe we've been able to exceed our goal of 15% minority participation for the past few years. We're moving our goal up for next year to 17%, and as I said earlier, we hope to shoot for 20% by the start of the next biennium. I should have shown this earlier. This is just the fluctuation of new apprentices, brand new apprentices registered in the system each year. You can see that drop during the recession, and you can see what we do, because apprenticeship is one of the few workforce investment strategies that requires a job. You can see as the economy gets better, our numbers go back up, and in a best case scenario, we'll be back over 3,500 new registrations soon. That's our hope. In order to meet that demand that's coming up, we know that things are changing. Employers want new people. We are making changes with respect to how we do business. We need to focus more on outreach, recruitment, and facilitation. That's outreach to new workers, but also outreach and facilitation with new employers. Compliance is important, but the vast majority of our programs know what they have to do, know how to operate their programs. We don't have to remediate a lot of them. We can now turn some of our attention to outreach and facilitation. We're a relatively small office, 18 FTEs, so we can't go out and hit every employer. But we plan on, and we've started to use the services that are available through the state workforce system. The employment department has agreed to take one of their employment analysts and co-locate them with us in our Portland office, and they will have one goal: to go out in Portland and rural areas of the state and talk to employers, educate them about structured work-based learning, educate them about registered apprenticeship, educate them about the benefits, try to create new programs with new employers. As I stated earlier, we're collaborating with the Department of Education to establish a position that will articulate high school career pathways with the apprenticeship curriculum taught in the adult training centers. We're also partnering with Business Oregon to come up with a strategy to do outreach into rural parts of the state. With respect to outreach for our applicants, as Commissioner Avakian mentioned earlier, we do have a partnership with the Oregon Department of Transportation. our Heavy Highway Supportive Services Program. By statute, ODOT is required to expend one half of 1%, up to $2.1 million every biennium, in its federal funds to increase diversity in the highway construction workforce and prepare individuals for entry into highway trades occupations. Based on a contractual arrangement with ODOT, we run that program. We then contract most of the work out with various vendors to provide services to potential applicants, things like teaching pre-apprenticeship programs, outreach and recruitment. One of the biggest things we've seen, and this is why we've got better retention, is we help those apprentices with supportive services. If they need basic skills improvement, they're in their apprenticeship program, but they can't do the math, we can get them and pay for them to take a remedial math class. We can provide them with career counseling. We can assist them with transportation from job site to job site. Construction's a mobile business. If you're a brand new apprentice in the Portland area and your first dispatch is a year-long job to build a bridge in Medford, you're going to need help getting there. We can help them get there. We buy tools and equipment for new apprentices.
Mr. Sims, let me stop you for just a second. What's the efficacy of taking a new apprentice and taking him down to Medford? I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is, where's the local pool in Medford? And rather than undertaking this increased expense, because there's transportation, there's living on the job, there's reconcile the regional inequity in that you're taking Portland people to go work in Medford that still is trying to recover from the recession itself.
Co-Chair Johnson, that is a question that I asked our training directors and administrators myself. I agree. I think particularly when you're talking about people new to the trades, they should have good entry-level jobs where they can feel comfortable in, build themselves up. Sending them to Medford doesn't do any good. There are people in Medford who want to work. Our training directors say, get used to it. It's the construction trade. We send them where we want to. This is our challenge, to get them to see that there are better ways to do business.
Except for the fact that you have some roadmap, and I know you can't hold ODOT to it, but you've got the roadmap of the state transportation infrastructure, the various STIPs. You've got all of these plans that in the heavy highway that fold up so that you've got some kind of a roadmap about we're going to be doing a huge project in Pendleton next year. And can't there be some effort to harmonize those?
And Chair Johnson, to the extent that the agency can, and ODOT's been our partner on this, we do. We get the STIP building schedule. If we know in a year there'll be a big project starting in a certain part of the state, we will solicit vendors in that part of the state to do recruitment and pre-training. So you've got that pool down there. People from that pool who choose to apply, and for what it's worth, unfortunately, most of our larger programs are all centered in Portland, so that Medford or that Pendleton applicant's applying to Portland, and they're in that Portland pool. And this is just something we have to work with our training directors to see. You're better off dispatching a local apprentice than saying they're all in my pool, they've got to learn to travel. There are some things about the construction industry that have been done the same way for years, and they don't necessarily want to change. Some of our programs have, and some of our employers have, but it's going to take time and technical assistance to make them see you're better off using local people. But it's just one of those things that we struggle with in getting our employers to see the logic in that.
Representative Whitson.
And I hope the panel corrects me if I'm wrong, but I think we heard testimony from subcontractors for ODOT that they oftentimes are losing money because the women and minorities quit. This goes to what Senator Johnson is saying, because they aren't either capable, able, or willing to travel. Once they get on the job, they quit because they don't like it. And so it ends up costing a great deal more for the subcontractors, which, in my opinion, it's a sort of a trickle-up thing. Eventually, I think it costs ODOT more, even though the director said it doesn't cost ODOT more. I do not see how it could not cost ODOT more. So, I am all for women and minorities. I personally was a geologist in a previous life and was one of the first females to ever sit deep drilling rigs in the overthrust of the Rocky Mountains. And I know what it takes. It was hard work, and so I appreciate that women can do it, but I'm concerned also, like the senator, what are we going to do so that we don't have these cost overruns for the subcontractors, which is driving the cost of everything up, in my opinion.
And through the co-chairs, I don't really think it cost, and this is part of the mystery of solving the diversity issue. In the long run, it doesn't cost that contractor more money. If they can't find that apprentice, female, minority, or otherwise, who wants to travel, they'll find somebody else. They'll find them either locally or find someone who does want to travel. Our effort, what we're trying to convince the contractors and the local apprenticeship committees, is hire the local person. Hire the person where the work is. There are some existing work rules that I believe there's flexibility in, where they say we have to hire this next person on our out-of-work list. I think there's flexibility there if they're willing to look at it. I don't really think it affects the diversity. What we do in any event where a woman, person of color, or an economically disadvantaged person gets a dispatch and they can't travel or they need new tools, we'll work with our ODOT funds to pay for that. We'd like to pay for that locally as opposed to spending that money to send someone elsewhere. But there are just some things in the industry that we need to work with them to see that it's better off to be flexible than adhering to old rules that may no longer be applicable to the workplace.
Okay, could I still don't understand how, if it costs a subcontractor more by sending someone in when someone quits to redo the work or finish the work, how that ultimately doesn't end up costing ODOT money. Or, I mean, I'm not getting that. It costs somebody money. Do they just absorb it, or the next project they go to, the subcontractor charge more? I'm sure somebody else must understand what I'm trying to ask here. If somebody's losing money, I mean, ultimately, doesn't someone else pay for that?
Through the co-chairs, I don't know if those sub, and I was not here to benefit from those subcontractors' testimony, but I don't think their issue is so much that they are spending additional public dollars on the project. They're saying that if they get a dispatch from a distant area and that person doesn't want to come, then they have to spend more money from a personnel standpoint on finding someone. I don't necessarily think they're saying that the work is done improperly. It's how they staff it.
Right.
But and it's finding the staffing for it, which I think is the issue. And we agree, I think that I agree with the committee members that it would be much better off to staff it locally, and that's a matter of continuing to work with these committees and our apprenticeship programs and say it's better off to do your work locally as opposed to, sometimes you're going to have to import labor, but it's better off using local people when you can. With respect to the supportive services program, we've seen results. We've seen increases in our female and minority completion rates. We've seen the percentage of new female and minority workers in the highway trades go from 16.5% of all apprentices in 2009 when we started the program to now women and people of color make up 26.9% of all new apprentices in the heavy highway trades. So we're proud of the work we're doing. We're constantly readjusting the program to the needs of the industry. This program is currently overseen by one operations and policy analyst, two, and one limited duration office specialist, two. You will see in our budget that we have a policy option package number 105. The purpose of that policy option package is to permanently establish the office specialist, two position within our budget. To ensure our continued ability to meet the needs and obligations of its contract with ODOT. We've got performance measures directly related to the participation of women and people of color in these programs and to the overall completion, so we feel our efforts justify the creation of this OS2 position to support the program. Just in closing, I'd like to say that we know that we have to address the workforce development issue on both ends. Product coming in, product that goes to the employers. We will continue to look at other resources, other agencies, and other avenues to make that happen. We will continue to reach out to employers to find out what they need to build their workforce. Our simple goal is to make sure that our employers are strong, but equally important that all Oregonians have the opportunity to access a living wage career. That concludes my overview. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sims.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And I believe our wage and hour administrator, Gerhard Toivel, will be doing the wage and hour presentation.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Gerhard Toivel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. I saw a statistic not long ago, that a federal statistic that said there are about 135 businesses in Oregon that employ employees, and about 1.7 million employees in Oregon. And for the majority of these people, in one way or another, the laws that the Wage and Hour Division enforces touches upon what they do in the workplace. The purposes of these laws are generally to establish basic workplace standards in the areas of wages and working conditions, to keep minors safe in the workplace, to license farm labor contractors in order to minimize wage disputes in agricultural employment, and to ensure that state-mandated wage rates are paid to workers on public works projects. The division's activities are comprised generally of three kinds: efforts to resolve wage disputes between employers and employees through a wage collection program, efforts to ensure compliance with minimum standards through investigations of complaints and licensing, and efforts to affect compliance by providing information to the public about the wage and hour regulations.
Let me stop you and just ask a question. Part of your program, as you just described, is complaint-driven. Are every one of those complaints investigated, or how do you go about triaging the complaints?
Senator Johnson, we have two different kinds of programs. We receive wage claims from individuals who want to file a wage claim or want to bring a wage claim against an employer because they believe they weren't paid properly. There are certain kinds of wage claims that we screen out, so we're not investigating every one, but in general, most of those wage claims will be investigated if the division has jurisdiction and meets our acceptance policy. We also receive complaints from individuals. Some of these are anonymous complaints against businesses where a person could be a worker, might not be, wants to bring some kind of alleged violation to the Bureau's attention. We do not investigate every complaint that we receive. There are thousands of these complaints that we receive on an annual basis. We just don't have the resources to look at every one. What we do is we have a system where when we receive multiple complaints against an employer for a similar issue within a period of time, we will then open up a case to investigate against that employer. But we're not responding to every individual complaint that we receive. We do, however, give priority to certain kinds of complaints. So for example, if someone alerts us that a minor is working on a roof somewhere, we will respond to that. But other kinds of complaints don't get that same kind of priority.
Thank you. That was helpful. Okay, please continue.
So each year the division receives thousands of claims, complaints, and inquiries related to the laws that it enforces. This slide before you illustrates, as a kind of snapshot, the demand for services that the division receives, with most of these numbers being an average over the last several years. So as you can see, on average, we receive about 1,300 wage claims every year against an employer. We also, at the same time, receive about 500 wage claims filed annually seeking payout from the state's Wage Security Fund program. This is a program that was initiated by the legislature since in 1985, I believe in response to, at that time, a number of closures in the timber industry that left workers having worked without receiving their final wages. So the legislature enacted a program where employees could file wage claims with us, and we would take a look at them. If they had a valid claim and they were owed wages for wages that they had earned within the last 60 days of their employment or within the last 60 days of the business's existence, they could file a claim and be eligible for a payout. Initially, that was a capped at $2,000. It's now capped at $4,000. And we still, as you can see, receive a good number of claims against that program. We also conduct investigations in response to complaints that we receive. Some of these complaints are complaints filed on prevailing wage projects, and our prevailing wage unit, which is located within the wage and hour division, investigates about 150 or conducts about 150 audits of public works projects every year. Incidentally, the prevailing wage unit also provides numerous seminars around the state, free seminars for contractors who have worked on public works projects or would like to work on public works projects and would like more information, as well as seminars geared to contracting agencies which have or will be letting contracts for prevailing wage projects.
This is an old complaint of mine. It's agencies doing trainings around the state at the considerable expense that it takes to drive somebody to Le Grand, put them up overnight, do the training, drive them back. Do you not have the ability to put some of your curriculum or curricula on CDs or some way to get it to Pendleton in a uniform way that has all of the salient points without sending people out to do it every time?
Senator Johnson, in fact, the information that we provide in those seminars is also readily available on our website. For example, we have a prevailing wage rate law book, which we put on the website. It has all the information that either a contractor or contracting agency would like to receive. I think going forward, we're going to continue to look at perhaps putting seminars somehow on our website as well that people can watch that presentation. But the reality is that for the most part, the seminars are pretty well attended, even in the remoter areas of the state. And so as long as there's a demand, I think probably there will always be room for us to do something like that. In addition, division staff respond to about 30,000 inquiries each year. And just to be clear, because I know there'll be a presentation later from the Technical Assistance for Employers program, these are inquiries that are coming primarily from workers who are asking questions about their rights in the workplace. The division has a child labor unit whose responsibility is to issue employment certificates to employers who want to employ minors in the state. This is a free certificate, but what the program allows us to do is to take a look at what employers are going to ask their minor employees to do and to make sure that the employers are not employing minors in occupations which are hazardous and which would not comply with either state or federal law. It also allows us to interact with employers to see, you know, what kinds of hours the minors will be working and make sure that they're working within hours that are acceptable under the wage and hour laws. Finally, we license farm and forest labor contractors, and beginning in July of this year, we will be licensing construction labor contractors as well. On average, we have about 300 applicants each year for a farm or forest labor contractor license. How many construction labor contractor licenses we can expect is an unknown at this point, but we don't expect that that's going to change a great deal.
And how will that be financed?
Senator Johnson, they are financed by a fee that the contractors pay. The basic fee is $150 per year. The license is an annual license. With the farm and forest labor contractors, those fees may vary somewhat depending on the kind of license an individual wants to get. For example, there's a dual farm and forest labor license that one can get, which costs more. But the basic fee is $150 per year. This graph is meant to demonstrate the division's processing of the wage claims that I alluded to earlier. And before I give you an idea of the wage claim process itself, I would like to point out in the previous slide that was sort of the incoming materials that the division gets. The output is that the division conducts approximately 1,600 wage claim investigations and 240 complaint investigations each year, and we recover approximately $1.8 million for Oregon workers who haven't been paid properly. That number includes both agreed rate wages, minimum wages, overtime wages, and prevailing wages. In addition, through the Wage Security Fund program, we issue payouts of approximately $650,000 each year to about 450 displaced workers. To give you some kind of context on how that happens, I'd like to just briefly describe what our wage claim process is. Essentially, any Oregon worker can file a wage claim against an employer. What the Bureau does with that information is initially we screen the wage claim, make sure that there are no jurisdictional issues. For example, the work wasn't performed in Washington, for example, by an Oregon worker, and that it meets our acceptance requirements. Then we are in contact with the claimant, make sure that we understand what the wage claim is, that identifying who the claimant is, who the employer is, what the reason for the claim is, what the period of the claim is, and so forth, and that there is evidence that there's some kind of something in dispute. We then notify the employer of the complaint. It's called a notice of claim, and the employer then has 10 business days, is asked to respond to us within 10 business days with an answer to that complaint. Some employers will, upon receiving notice of claim, will agree that the wages are owed and will send payment to the Bureau, at which point we will forward that payment on to the claimant and then close that claim because there's not more for us to do at that point. More frequently, however, an employer will respond either to dispute the claim because there's something at issue and the employer does not feel that wages are owed, or, as also happens, the employer just will not respond or does not respond to that initial notice of claim. For that response, either a non-response or a refutation of the claim, we will then assign that to an investigator. The investigator will look at the evidence provided, gather more evidence if that's needed to investigate the claim, and then render a decision and try to resolve that wage claim directly with the employer. What this graph shows is that about 83% of the wage claims that we receive are resolved one way or another within 90 days of the claim being assigned to an investigator. In fact, probably about 65% of those claims are resolved within 30 days of being assigned to an investigator. So in general, we can pretty expediently handle a number of the wage claims that are filed with the agency. As I said, at this point, an investigator, if there's a finding that wages are owed, will attempt to settle the wage claim directly with the employer. In many cases, we're able to do that. I think probably around 75 or 80% of the wage claims actually get resolved in that manner. If we're not able to do that, and their wages are owed, then we will issue an order of determination. And in response to that, an employer can either choose to select to have an administrative hearing to hear the matter, or can opt to take the case to court for a trial. With regard to the processing of Wage Security Fund claims, This graph shows that about 80% of the wage claims that are eligible for payout from the Wage Security Fund are processed by the investigator within 30 days of being assigned to the compliance specialist. We give priority to these claims, the circumstances being what they are. You know, business has gone out of business, leaving workers unpaid. In many cases, these are not, you know, the workers who are applying for payout from the Wage Security Fund are not highly paid workers. They live from week to week or from paycheck to paycheck, and so they depend very much on whatever support they can receive from the Wage Security Fund. And so for that reason, we prioritize them. It's also, you know, from an investigative point of view, a practical matter, because these are businesses that don't exist anymore. They're defunct. And so to get the kind of information that we need, the payroll records, the time records, to corroborate that the claim is valid, to corroborate that the employer is not in a position to pay the wages, you know, we have to move quickly, and we do. And so many of these claims, as I said, are resolved within 30 days of the claim being assigned to an investigator. An example of how this process works, for example, last year in the Portland area, we had a large nursery that found itself going out of business, couldn't pay a number of workers who worked there. We, in fact, got claims from about over 130 workers, eventually paying out over $185,000 in unpaid wages from the Wage Security Fund. We were able to work with the receiver for this company to get the kinds of records that we needed to make the payouts that the workers were eligible for to receive. But we didn't stop there. We continued to work with the receiver, and actually were able to collect another $185,000-$190,000 from the receiver, which we could pay the remainder of the wages that were still owed to the workers, because if you remember, there's a cap on what you can receive through the Wage Security Fund. Some of these workers had other wages that they were entitled to that couldn't be paid from the Wage Security Fund. So with the wages that we were able to collect from the receiver, we were able to pay those wages as well as reimburse the Wage Security Fund for a portion of the monies that we spent.
Go ahead. Representative Witsit first, then Senator Monroe.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, how much of your budget, if any, goes to the Department of Justice to pay them for attorneys' work in Boley? I mean, it's sort of a general question. I assume you don't have lawyers on staff when you have to prosecute someone.
Co-chairs and Representative Witsit, well, two things. We have what's called an administrative prosecution unit, so those would be our in-house attorneys, although they're not acting as attorneys. But when an employer, for example, requests a hearing, an administrative hearing that goes through the administrative process, then we use our own internal staff. If in response to a wage claim, for example,
anything, okay. Fully, I mean, it's a big part, isn't it?
Yes, then we do need to use the Department of Justice attorneys. We do have, in our budget is built in a budget for attorney fees, and that depends on what program, you know, whether it's prevailing wage, wage collection, minimum wage.
I want to go back to your situation where there was a receiver and there were other assets in the company. The first question that I've got is, you only pay for work performed, do you not? Even if there's a gap between work performed and what the cap of the reimbursement fund is?
Senator Johnson, that's correct. It has to be hours actually worked, that wages that the worker is entitled to.
Okay. And in this particular instance, there were workers that had worked beyond the cap, and you paid beyond the cap?
There were workers who were owed wages in excess of $4,000, and since the Wage Security Fund payout is capped at $4,000, we could only pay that amount as a maximum, even though they were owed more than that.
And then what percentage do you attempt to subrogate, particularly if there are companies that are in receivership that theoretically might have other assets that you could claim? Where are you in the claimant order, and how often do you attempt to subrogate?
Senator Johnson, with regard to receivership, there is, in fact, a wage and hour law that talks explicitly about receiverships and says wage claimants are sort of at the top of the line when it comes to a situation like that for wages owed. Now, and this kind of goes to Representative Whitsett's question as well, to enforce that, I mean, we would have to go to DOJ and, you know, take them to court, essentially, to do something like that. In this particular case, just by pointing that out to the receiver and showing them that, you know, this is the rights that the workers have, and as assignee of those rights, because they have filed wage claims, that we were going to assert that, we were able to come to an understanding that they would then reimburse us for the work that we had done.
You make that sound like an anomaly rather than the norm.
Senator Johnson, it is an anomaly rather than the norm. We don't see too many cases, for example, that go to where a receiver is involved. More likely, with a larger company, maybe there's a bankruptcy, and we can make a payout from the Wage Security Fund and then pursue the wages through the bankruptcy if there are any assets. But quite frankly, many employers that have gone defunct, there are no assets. And so we have to make the choice whether we're going to pursue some kind of legal action against a company that appears to be out of business and doesn't have assets that we can pursue or that is readily available for collection.
Thank you. I need to excuse myself for the last 15 minutes of the hearing. I've got an appointment.
Okay. As I had mentioned earlier, the prevailing wage rate unit is located within the wage and hour division. We investigate about 150 complaints a year against contractors who have performed work on public works projects. As you can see from this graph, we complete about 58% of those investigations within 90 days. This is a little below what our performance goal is, which was set a couple of years ago to 64%. But as you can see, it's not out of line with what we've been able to achieve over the last several years. I think the reason for this is that unlike a wage claim investigation where it's a single wage claimant and, you know, an employer that you're investigating, a prevailing wage investigation is really an audit of a business. It's an audit of a contractor who is performing work on a public works project, may have multiple employees, may have been on that project for multiple weeks, many weeks. And oftentimes there are some very complex questions involved or information that needs to be obtained. Probably one of the most usual of the complaints is that workers have been underpaid by a contractor because they have been misclassified in the type of work that they do. If you're not familiar with the prevailing wage regulations, essentially every year the Wage and Hour Division through the Employment Department conducts a survey. Out of that survey come prevailing wage rates that need to be paid to workers on public works projects. But those classifications of work are various. So within any prevailing wage publication which reports the rates that need to be paid, there are multiple classifications of workers: carpenters, laborers, electricians, plumbers, and the list goes on and on. So a common complaint is that workers on a project, for example, were paid at a labor rate rather than a carpenter rate, which the allegations they were really doing carpentry work, they were paid as a laborer, the labor rate is less than the carpenter rate, and so there's a difference in what they should have been paid. This means that for the investigator investigating a complaint of that kind, it means looking at time and payroll records, means ascertaining what the actual work was for several weeks oftentimes on a daily basis. And so it requires talking not only to the contractors and the contracting agencies, perhaps the prime contractor, but also to multiple workers to ferret out exactly what work was performed. The stakes are sometimes high, so there's a lot of given back and forth with contractors, and I think all of that adds up to the timeline you see here on this graph. It takes a long time in many cases to get through a prevailing wage investigation, you know, in less than in 3 months. Finally, and this is also in the area of prevailing wage, several years ago, the legislature created a process in statute where BOLI would receive information from any person, any entity that wanted to receive a coverage determination or a predetermination about a project, and we would take a look at that information, then render an opinion whether that project was going to be covered by the public, by the prevailing wage regulations or not. I think in large measure this was because the definition of what a public work is has changed significantly over time. Perhaps in large measure in response to the increase of public money in private projects. So these public-private partnerships and projects have sometimes set up very complex and confusing to determine whether or not the prevailing wage regulations will and should apply to them. So a process was set up where BOLI would offer an opinion whether, based on the information provided to it, it appeared that the project was going to be covered by the prevailing wage regulations. A requester doesn't have to agree with our decision. If they don't, if we find that it's covered and they don't like that answer, then they can appeal that decision and can go to an administrative hearing for a final resolution.
Excuse me. We have a question from Senator Monroe.
Many employees in a construction site would do work that would be at different classifications, right? Some higher and some lower. How do you determine what the proper prevailing wage is for that person? Is it based on where the greatest preponderance of their work is done, or do they get paid for the highest classification of any of the jobs that they did?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Monroe, the investigator will look at, say, in a given day, what work that employee actually was doing. So if they spent 2 hours working as a carpenter, and then 2 hours working as a laborer, then 2 hours working as something else, that contractor would have to pay them accordingly for all those blocks of time that they were doing different kinds of work. It can get difficult.
Yeah, I can see where that could be really difficult and where mistakes could easily be made, honest mistakes, if you please.
Yes, and we do hear that sometimes from contractors, where if you have employees who are just sort of shuttling between different kinds of jobs, how do you track that time? And I think it's sort of the reasonableness standard. I mean, if you look at a day, can you break down in that day how much time that worker spent doing one type of activity versus another type of activity?
I can see why the investigation takes 3 months. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please.
So I don't think I need to say more than about this graph. As you can see, we complete those predetermination requests in a very timely manner. We receive probably 30 to 40 of such requests every year. So just to summarize my presentation, from what I've mentioned earlier, demand for services from the wage and hour division remains constant and has remained constant over the years. As you can see, the program, the wage collection program, offers a timely resolution for disputes between employees and employers for in the area of wages, allegations that wages have not been paid. As I mentioned, we're able to quickly, fairly quickly, get through those kinds of wage claim investigations and keep the claimants from necessarily going to small claims court or getting an attorney to handle that dispute. And in this way, I think we also improve Oregonians' access to justice because they, you know, this is a low-cost alternative for them than investing their own time or money in some other kind of legal process. Through our investigations of complaints and claims, we aim to protect the wages and working conditions on the job for all of Oregon's employees. And in doing so, I think we help. Indirectly, we help employers too, because for every employer, and most employers, I would say, you know, are abiding with the law, are following what the requirements are, but those that don't are effectively undercutting those employers who do, and so all employers who abide with the law are benefiting by the services that the Wage and Hour Division carries out. So with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
Further questions? Looks like we're good. Oh, please, Senator Monroe.
So on that last point, it appears to me that it's very important that BOLI do its job carefully, because otherwise somebody might be unjustly charged. I'm becoming more convinced that, you know, if we want to keep the all the lawyers out there unemployed, we need you.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Commissioner, I see we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. I think you have two more divisions that are going to report to us. I think this would probably be a good place for us to break and jump into those tomorrow.
That'd be fine.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing. And tomorrow we'll be hearing about the Civil Rights Division and the Technical Assistance Division. Is that correct? And public testimony. Anything for the good of the order? Then we are adjourned. Sure. We are adjourned.